one-man revolution. A guerrilla scholar warrior. A renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Democracy leads to oligarchy and necessarily contains an oligarchical nucleus. Thus wrote Robert Michels little over a century ago. Hey, Prof. CJ here. Welcome to the Dangerous History Podcast. I'm going to do another one of those episodes on important theories, concepts, whatever you want to call them, that I learned along the way that opened my eyes a bit more to the world and how it really works and what's really going on. And in this episode, I'm going to take a look at a very important concept in theory to understanding the world and how, particularly how power works and how organizations work, and that is the iron law of oligarchy. Now, this concept is definitely closely related to the concept of esoteric versus exoteric, which I talked about back in episode 20 of the Dangerous History Podcast. So if you've listened to that one already, you'll see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same thing. Though this law originated in the field of sociology, it has clear relevance to political science and also to history, as well as just to plain understanding the world around you, even if you're not looking back at the past, if you're just trying to understand the present. Well, first off, I would argue you can't do that unless you understand the past at least somewhat. But even if you're only looking at the present itself, I think you won't catch all of what's really going on unless you have at least a basic understanding of this law. So here's my basic boiled-down summary of the Iron Law of Oligarchy in my words. Now, later you'll get more words from Robert Michels, who originated the law, but here's my take on it. Every organization that is of any significant size or complexity will inevitably turn oligarchic, meaning it will be ruled by a small group, regardless of how democratic the organization's stated ideology might be. So even an organization, an institution, a political party, a labor union, whatever, that is all about democracy, that if you read its platform today, if you look at its website, is democracy this, democracy that, in reality, in practice, it's really run by a small group of people. This tendency is inherent in organizations and institutions, no matter how democratic they might claim to be or appear to be at first glance. And also, it's sort of just the way things work out, the logic of the institutions themselves, that it doesn't even matter so much the intentions of the people who end up being the leaders, who end up being the oligarchs. It doesn't even matter. They might not even be intending to make themselves oligarchs, and it'll just sort of happen. Over time, it'll evolve that way. Now, before looking at the Iron Law of Oligarchy in more detail, I think we ought to talk at least briefly about the originator of this law, who was definitely an interesting guy and an interesting thinker, to say the least. His name was Robert Michels, and he lived from 1876 to 1936. He was a German sociologist who came from an affluent background. As a young man, he was educated at multiple universities throughout Europe, and in several different countries. Apparently, he was fluent in multiple languages. He eventually became a socialist and an activist for a number of years in the German Social Democratic Party, which he ultimately ended up leaving in 1907. He personally knew and was a student of German intellectuals from the era who are perhaps more famous, more well-known, such as Max Weber and Werner Sombart. After getting his degrees, Michels taught at universities in Germany, Italy, and Switzerland. At the time that he wrote the book Political Parties, which is the book that in which he outlined the Iron Law of Oligarchy, he, from what I've been able to dig up, was professing himself to be an anarcho-syndicalist. So apparently he had already by this time left the German Social Democratic Party, apparently from being disillusioned by its oligarchic tendencies that he talked about in this book. And the book, if you're interested in reading it, is called Political Parties, and the subtitle is A Sociological Study of the Oligarchical Tendencies of Modern Democracy. It was first published in 1911 and has been republished, reprinted, probably too many times to keep track of in lots of different languages. So Mikkels was a socialist, got disillusioned by observing the phenomenon we're going to talk about in the Iron Law of Oligarchy, became some sort of left anarchist for a while. However, after World War II, he made a move that might seem surprising. He became a fascist and a supporter of Benito Mussolini in Italy. He apparently was convinced by this point that charismatic, even if somewhat authoritarian, leadership actually offered the best way to benefit the masses without the oligarchical tendencies found in political parties. In other words, he thought by having a fascist type of a charismatic leader, you wouldn't have as much oligarchy, institutionally speaking, because the charismatic leader would be able to sort of cut through that stuff. So, ardent supporter of Mussolini, and in the late 1920s, Benito Mussolini personally offered Robert Mikkels a chair at the University of Perugia in Italy, where, Mikkels moved there and taught there and ended up dying in Rome in 1936 at the age of 60. So that's just a brief sketch on who he was. Probably you haven't heard of him unless you're somebody who's like real big into this kind of stuff. He's not as much of a household name as lots of other intellectuals from the same, late 19th or 20th century time period. Now, to his Iron Law of Oligarchy, which is probably his most significant contribution to academia, to scholarship. His Iron Law of Oligarchy as outlined in Political Parties. In Political Parties, Robert Mikkels argues that all human organizations tend toward oligarchy in practice. It does not matter what the content of their ideology is, their platform, their stated purpose or goals. Inevitably, once an organization reaches even a modest amount of size and complexity, it will tend toward oligarchy just because of sort of natural forces and internal dynamics and the logic of what it's doing. Mikkels writes, quote, "The most formidable argument against the sovereignty of the masses is derived from the mechanical and technical impossibility of its realization," end quote. Now, in Political Parties, Mikkels is making this thesis that this iron law of oligarchy always sort of pops up in any institution of any modest to significant size. So he mostly looks at institutions that are ostensibly very democratic, which back then meant sort of the Democratic Socialist Party, such as the German Social Democratic Party or its rough equivalent in other European countries. He looks at a lot of these sort of parties. And then he also looks to some extent at trade unions, which are very much tied into these same parties at the time. Now, there's good reason why he looks at these sort of groups and doesn't really look at what you might consider more conservative, right-wing, or elitist political parties and organizations. Why he looks at the ones with the most democratic, at least sounding, ideologies. Because if he looked only at elitist, conservative, reactionary, whatever you want to call them type organizations, and found oligarchical tendencies there, that really wouldn't strongly prove his thesis, because everybody would expect that those types of parties and organizations would be oligarchical. I mean, that's in a lot of ways what they're advocating. The more conservative parties in European politics in the early 20th century oftentimes are defending things like aristocracy and even monarchy. So by looking at the most self-professed democratic and egalitarian parties and still discovering oligarchical tendencies in them, Mikkels very much strengthens his argument. And I'm not going to go into all of the details that he goes through. If you're interested in this, you can go read it for yourself. He goes through just exhaustively the details of all these long-defunct now European socialist parties and to a lesser extent some of the unions. I'm looking more at the theory itself and kind of how can it apply, does it apply more broadly to kind of history as a whole and to more recent times and organizations that you might be more familiar with and frankly that I'm more familiar with. I am not a world-class expert on late 19th and early 20th century European social democracy parties. I have some familiarity with them. I've studied them at both the undergrad and graduate levels, but anybody who studied these sorts of things in any detail knows it is very easy to just get totally lost in the weeds. So I'm going to try to avoid that as much as possible and look more at the theory itself and then various times and places how it applies or does not apply. So an institution of any decent size or complexity or both is going to need something like bureaucracy, whether it calls it bureaucracy or not. It's going to need people who are the functionaries who carry out administrative functions. It's going to need delegation. It's going to need representation. In other words, an organization of any significant size tends to make direct democracy logistically just impossible, at least in most cases. In other words, you're going to have functionaries, you're going to have leaders. And as the organization gets larger, and perhaps even as it also gets successful, like a party that starts to gain in votes and support, it becomes ever more important to have people in positions of leadership and control and administration who have specific skill sets. Skill sets which the masses generally lack. So in other words, there are good practical reasons for these elites developing, but the problem is, once they develop, they quickly get out of the control of the actual rank and file of the party or union or whatever it is. So a couple passages from Mickles in Political Parties. Gradually, the delegates' duties became more complicated. Some individual ability becomes essential, a certain oratorical gift, and a considerable amount of objective knowledge. It thus becomes impossible to trust to blind chance, to the fortune of alphabetic succession, or to the order of priority in the choice of a delegation whose members must possess certain peculiar personal aptitudes if they are to discharge their mission to the general narrative. End quote. In other words, for the party to be successful, it has to have people in prominent positions who possess certain skills that are just not universal. More from Mickles, quote, "The technical specialization that inevitably results from all extensive organization renders necessary what is called expert leadership. Consequently, the power of determination comes to be considered one of the specific attributes of leadership and is gradually withdrawn from the masses to be concentrated in the hands of the leaders alone. Thus, the leaders, who were at first no more than the executive organs of their collective will, soon emancipate themselves from the mass and become independent of its control. Organization implies the tendency to oligarchy. In every organization, whether it be a political party, a professional union, or any other association of the kind, the aristocratic tendency manifests itself very clearly. The mechanism of the organization, while conferring a solidity of structure, induces serious changes in the organized mass, completely inverting the respective positions of the leaders and the led. As a result of organization, every party or professional union becomes divided into a minority of directors and a majority of directed." End quote. I think that's very interesting, and it shows you how practice and theory don't line up when it comes to democracy, right? It's just like how in the United States today, everybody talks about, you know, this is government of, by, and for the people, and we the people are in charge, and we are the government, and the government represents us and works for us, and blah, 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 blah. And those are just platitudes and rhetoric. Those are statements of theoretically how things are supposed to be, but it's not how they are, nor how they ever actually were, by the way, in practice. In real life, there's always been a relatively small elite that are pulling the levers of power and make most of the decisions that really matter. In practice, the elite goes along with what the majority wants when it coincides with the elite's interests. But when the interests of the masses and the interests of the elite do not coincide, 90%+ of the time, the elites are gonna do what's in their interests. And if you don't believe me, go back and look up in 2008, the Wall Street bailout, overwhelmingly opposed by the American people. I mean, some polls had it, you know, 80%+ of the American people dead set against bailing out Wall Street. Now, You can't get 80%+ of the American people to agree on a damn thing. You can't get 80%+ of the American people to agree on a sunny day that it's not raining out, right? You can't get 80%+ of the American people to agree that puppies are cute. And yet, here they were agreeing on a significant political question. If you have 80% in agreement, then that means you got a hell of a lot of people from different parties, different backgrounds, and people who normally don't agree on anything with each other, right? And yet they agreed on that, and yet what happened? The bailout passed. So that to me is a wonderful case study of when the interests of the elite on something important to them contradict the preferences of the people they're supposed to represent. They will go with their own interests. They will not yield to the people they supposedly represent. So that the Wall Street bailout getting passed to me is a wonderful, very recent history example of the iron law of oligarchy in practice. Now back to some more from Robert Michels himself. Quote, "As organization develops, not only do the tasks of the administration become more difficult and more complicated, but further, its duties become enlarged and specialized to such a degree that it is no longer possible to take them all in at a single glance. In a rapidly progressive movement, it is not only the growth in the number of duties, but also the higher quality of these, which imposes a more extensive differentiation of function. Nominally, and according to the letter of the rules, all the acts of the leaders are subject to the ever-vigilant criticism of the rank and file. In theory, the leader is merely an employee, bound by the instruction he receives. He has to carry out the orders of the mass, of which he is no more than the executive organ. But in actual fact, as the organization increases in size, this control becomes purely fictitious. The members have to give up the idea of themselves conducting or even supervising the whole administration, and are compelled to hand these tasks over to trustworthy persons, specially nominated for the purpose, to salaried officials. The rank and file must content themselves with summary reports, and with the appointment of occasional special committees of inquiry, yet this does not derive from any special change in the rules of the organization. It is by very necessity that a simple employee gradually becomes a leader, acquiring a freedom of action which he ought not to possess." So the representatives, even if still technically chosen, you know, formally elected somehow, by the rank and file, they come to have interests that are not always identical with those of the rank and file. An example is, in a union, the elite in a union might start to see it as being more in their interest to get along with management and to compromise more, because it keeps things smooth and keeps their power solid. And the rank and file might actually want to be more confrontational and be more radical. But the elite will keep things, you know, tamped down because it's bad for their position and stability of their job. In politics, this can take the form of the elites often wanting to compromise and moderate, even when the masses actually don't. Because if you're at or near the top of a given system, why on earth would you be interested in radically changing, you know, upsetting and rocking that boat and so on? And these representatives have the means, because of their positions and their skills and their access to certain privileges and powers and information, to get their way in cases where their interests conflict with the rank and file. In the overwhelming majority of cases, they get their way. Representation, in a true sense of the word, becomes impossible. And the representatives of the masses end up just becoming a new faction within the power elite. In other words, the leaders and bureaucrats who began ostensibly as servants of the masses quickly become the masters of the masses, again, regardless of intention. Quote from Michels, "All power proceeds in a natural cycle. Issuing from the people, it ends by raising itself above the people." End quote. Now, Michels thinks the masses just inherently, whether they realize it or not consciously, just want to be ruled. Quote, "The incompetence of the masses is almost universal throughout the domains of political life, and this constitutes the most solid foundation of the power of the leaders," end quote. And it's kind of interesting, when you look at the sections and the pages of the book Political Parties, Michels actually devotes more space to the psychological characteristics of the masses that seem to cause them to want you know, masters than he does to the actual organizational factors at work in creating these oligarchies. The leaders, other than in extraordinary circumstances, are usually able to turn their jobs into something approaching lifetime tenure position, and it sometimes can even turn it over to their family, to their children and their siblings and so on. Kind of a nepotism within a democracy. Gee, haven't seen any of that. Bush, Clinton, right? Thanks to a combination of their skills, the power they accumulate in their jobs and their offices, and sort of the nature of the mass is very susceptible to this sort of thing. So this might explain why Congress's, even though Congress's approval rating is awful, still the vast majority of senators and congressmen keep getting reelected time after time after time. And it takes a ridiculous scandal to, in most cases anyway, it takes a ridiculous scandal to prevent one of them from getting reelected if they want to get reelected. I mean, it takes something like, you know, a video of you raping a kid or just something absurd like that to get you out. It's amazing how many times people keep getting reelected even when there are serious ethics charges against them for bribery or something like that. They just keep getting reelected time after time. Well, once they're in that office, they're able to use the powers of that office, the perks and privileges and so on, to dig in and to put up really good defenses against insurgencies, both from the other factions within their own party and from the other parties. On this concept of turning your office into a lifetime sort of a tenure job, Nichols writes, quote, "One who holds the office of delegate acquires a moral right to that office, and delegates remain in office unless removed by extraordinary circumstances or in obedience to rules observed with exceptional strictness." By the way, that sounds to me something like term limits, you know, that are straightforward, written in stone. Back to Mickles's words. "An election made for a definite purpose becomes a life incumbency. Custom becomes a right. One who has for a certain time held the office of delegate ends by regarding that office as his own property. If refused reinstatement, he threatens reprisals, the threat of resignation being the least serious among these, which will tend to sow confusion among his comrades, and this confusion will continue until he is victorious," end quote. And a little bit more on this subject from Mickles, quote, "Expert knowledge, which the leadership acquires in matters inaccessible or almost inaccessible to the mass, gives him a security of tenure which conflicts with the essential principles of democracy." And these knowledge and skills can include things like oratory, writing, parliamentary skills, skills at sort of backroom scheming and negotiating and wheeling and dealing and so on. And the knowledge can include inside information, the ability, you know, to pressure people, maybe even blackmail people and so on, that one gains by being an insider, that one gains by being a part of the elite. You know how the system works, and you also know how to work the system. In addition, party leaders are usually able to effectively portray any threat to them, any insurgency from within the party, for example, as dangerous to party unity and therefore a threat to their electoral success. And unions can do a similar thing, too. If you challenge your union boss, who's acting like an oligarch, he can say, hey, wait a minute, if you're going to sow division within the union, you're going to sow division within the organization, and that's going to weaken us, and management's going to be able to exploit that division, and so on. And so this is a great way of keeping discipline within the party or union or whatever you're looking at. More often than not, using this tactic, especially when they couple it with their control of the party's actual bureaucracy, the establishment of the party is easily able to crush insurgencies, or if that's not possible or convenient, to co-opt them. And I would say, see the Tea Party as an example along these lines. I feel that the Republican Party, I think the Tea Party, when it first came out, first, like very early, when it first showed up, when most news people were not even aware of what the hell it was a genuine grassroots thing. And my observations were, and I went out of curiosity to some early Tea Party gatherings, like way early, you know, before the mainstream media was talking about it or anything. And it seemed to me, anyway, in what I observed, that there was pretty much equal hostility against both parties in these early Tea Party movements. And literally within a matter of a few months after I went to some of those, the Tea Party started turning into just another organ of the Republican Party, in a lot of ways, anyway. So, to me, the Tea Party has largely been totally co-opted by the Republican Party establishment, and in the process has just become another functionary, not a whole lot different from the establishment, other than, on, you know, they might be a little bit more harsh on the social issues or something like that, but the Republican Party establishment, within a year or two of the Tea Party showing up, pretty successfully co-opted what it could and crushed what it could not co-opt. So that from early 2009 onward, I think the Tea Party had pretty much lost its independence. And Mickles, I mean, people always point out when they're reviewing political parties, the book Political Parties or something like this, that it's a very pessimistic argument. And it is, but at the same time, you know, Mickles, his point is, look, I'm not getting into whether this is good or bad, whether I like it or not. I'm trying to accurately describe and analyze what is. And, you know, I think he has a point there. But it is kind of a pessimistic book because he doesn't offer solutions. He doesn't offer, but on the other hand, to me, that makes it realistic. He's not offering solutions. He said, look, this is how it actually works, you know? And there doesn't seem to be any sort of wonderful magic bullet, magic blanket, whatever, that can just, you know, wave a wand and fix this thing. And towards the end of Political Parties, it gets even more downbeat because Mickles starts speculating that some of the socialists, if they ever really got in charge of a country in a big way, could end up going really off the deep end. In other words, in extreme cases, the parties with some of the most egalitarian-sounding ideology and rhetoric of all could potentially become some of the most ruthless and oligarchical regimes in history if they ever got total control. And here, I think he was talking about the more extreme socialists, communists, and so on. In the introduction to the copy of Political Parties that's in my possession, which was published in 1968, the sociologist Seymour Martin Lipset writes that the Russian Revolution offered a dramatic confirmation of Mickles's prediction, quote, that a successful socialist revolution would mean not the triumph of democracy for the working class, but the replacement of one set of rulers by another, end quote. This, of course, to me, calls to mind the end of the novel Animal Farm by George Orwell, in which the animals who run the farm and originally took over saying they were going to make everything fair and egalitarian, more and more protect and enlarge their own privileges. You know, the handful, in the book, it's the pigs. The handful of animals that start to run the farm once the farmer is deposed, they start to become as bad or in some ways worse than the farmer. I think Orwell had brilliant insights into these sorts of things. So again, the communists become as bad or worse than those they replaced in terms of exploiting the workers and, you know, being an oppressive oligarchy. Oh, and by the way, Mickles did not accept the United States from his iron law either. He wrote, quote, "The North Americans, living under a Republican regime and knowing nothing of titles of nobility, by no means delivered themselves from aristocracy when they shook off the power of the English crown," end quote. He refers in his analysis of America very frequently to the writings of the French political scientist and philosopher Alexis de Tocqueville, who detailed a lot of America's budding aristocratic and oligarchic tendencies way back in the age of President Jackson. Already some of this stuff was there. Democracy in theory, according to Robert Mickles' Iron Law of Oligarchy, will become oligarchy in practice. Or in his words, who says organization says oligarchy. Now, the Iron Law of Oligarchy has been identified and observed in other contexts besides just socialist parties that Mickles looked at. It's been observed in, just to name a few places where you can find studies on this, things like medical associations, veterans groups, various types of pressure groups like lobby-type groups, and reform movements, trade unions. It's even been seen in some studies of the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, created by the New Deal. There have been some exceptions discovered, and scholars often fixate on these because they contradict Mickels, and of course, in academia, a great way to get attention and get your stuff published is to take on a big theory that's, you know, a major part of the bedrock ideas in your field, in your discipline. That's a great way to get attention, to get your paper. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I think in some ways it's good because it encourages criticism. It encourages, sort of like the scientific method does the same thing. People make a name for themselves by disproving something that most people basically believed in. So you can find some entire big scholarly articles and even a few entire books devoted to examples of organizations that seem to have defied or avoided the iron law of oligarchy. Perhaps the most famous exception among sociologists is that of the International Typographical Union, or ITU, Union of Printers, as laid out in the book Union Democracy by Seymour Martin Lipset, Martin Trow, and James S. Coleman, first published in 1956. These sociologists showed how the ITU was, in most ways, an exception to the iron law of oligarchy, largely because it was, in its structure, much more decentralized and much less hierarchical than other unions. The union officers had a lot less prestige and power, so they were much less differentiated from the rank and file, and there was a very high amount of rotation in office. And perhaps most importantly, there was widespread participation of the rank and file in actually running the organization. Now, why the organization developed that way seems to have just been sort of the contingent circumstances, the accidents of its history, that it just, for various reasons, evolved that way. It was, far as I've been able to tell, it did not evolve that way because of some plan. It wasn't like the people putting together this union sat down and said, okay, we're going to set up a union that's going to avoid the iron law of oligarchy. It was just sort of a matter of luck. Interestingly, though, the scholars who wrote this book, Union Democracy, did successfully, as far as we can tell, identify a genuine exception to the iron law of oligarchy. They themselves admit that most unions do totally follow the iron law of oligarchy tendencies. You know, the fact that they discovered an exception, well, what does an exception mean? It means it's a rare case where things don't go the way they normally do. In an article published in 1980 in the journal Social Problems, sociologist Winnie Brines applied the iron law of oligarchy to the New Left of the 1960s. You know, that sort of student radical movement mixed with civil rights and anti-war and all that stuff into a very radical blend of protest and direct action and all sorts of things designed to fight injustice and change society for the better. And in this article, Brines argued that the reason the New Left fizzled out roughly around the end of the 1960s was that they deliberately rejected the organization and institutionalism and hierarchy necessary to be successful in conventional politics. The New Left sought to avert the iron law of oligarchy, Brines writes, by its refusal to transform itself into a political party and by its insistence on remaining a social movement. This, while unsuccessful, Brines writes, quote, may well prove to have been the New Left's most valuable legacy, end quote. The New Left movement remained very decentralized and spontaneous, so by conventional standards, which of course are the standards of the establishment, keep in mind, the movement was a failure. But it actually remained more true to its beliefs, and of course it did, in a lot of ways, achieve a significant effect on the larger society and on the governmental system. You know, just look at the effect it had in terms of civil rights and opposition to the Vietnam War. In other words, I think you might say that the New Left chose principles over institutional success. Brines puts it this way, quote, the New Left and student movement represented a movement in which utopian, spontaneous, and participatory politics were affirmed. It should be recognized for the brave and significant experiment it was. To me, Occupy Wall Street may be seen, I think, as something somewhat along those same lines, though it obviously fizzled out a lot quicker and had far less of a lasting effect on society and the system than did the 1960s New Left. Now, why that is, I don't have a good theory at this point in time. I'm sure someone out there must have looked at this and made the comparisons and has theories why. I'd love to hear it. If you are very familiar with the New Left and with Occupy Wall Street, and you know have a good theory as to why the New Left was around longer and impacted things more, and Occupy Wall Street fizzled a lot quicker and did a lot less to really impact society, I'd be interested to hear it. If you've got a good article on it or something like that, send it along. One thing I'd throw out there as maybe just a possibility is perhaps because so many of the people involved in Occupy Wall Street are still, at the end of the day, to put it cynically, drinkers of the Obama Kool-Aid. In other words, they still have some sort of sentimental attachment to Obama as a person, as a charismatic guy, as a guy who talks the way they want him. They want their leaders to talk, even if he doesn't act that way very much. And so this made them kind of willing to settle down, even though they didn't get much in the way of real reforms or changes to the system. I don't know. Maybe that's the answer. Now, another exception to the Iron Law of Oligarchy, at least in a lot of ways, was ancient democratic Athens. There's a political scientist named C. Fred Alford, who in a 1985 article published in the Canadian Journal of Political Science, analyzed how ancient Athens had seemingly avoided having the Iron Law of Oligarchy pop up. As in the case of the International Typographical Union, in Athens, the average citizen was heavily involved in the politics and even in the administration of the city. Athens's administration was actually run, it had a pretty extensive administrative apparatus, you know, basically like bureaucrats and stuff. It was actually run by average citizens. You know, you could get a job for a year or whatever as some kind of an official at the port or some sort of clerk taking care of some kind of records. And these posts were often chosen by lot, not by election or appointment. Most adult citizens could expect to serve at least once in their lifetime in an important political or administrative position. Many of these positions were for very short terms, oftentimes 1 year. Many of them had term limits. Oftentimes you could not hold a particular office more than one time in your life. And even in cases where you could, there was often a prohibition on serving consecutive terms. So Athens had a fairly, you know, for a city of its size, had a fairly large and complex organization in its government, but it still managed to avoid creating a true oligarchy while running this government. This probably meant that Athens's administration was mediocre in terms of its competence. Alford points this out in this article from the Canadian Journal of Political Science. They might not have been the best people for the job, these people appointed by lot and so on. But the Athenians, from what we can tell, seem to have been fine with that as being kind of the necessary price of preventing oligarchy. In other words, hey, our administrators, our bureaucrats may not always be the most competent people, but at least it's not a permanent oligarchy who's going to develop its own set of interests and the ability to enforce those interests and blah, blah, blah. In other words, if they had highly capable administrators running the city's government, those administrators would have turned into an entrenched oligarchy. Ironically, Alford argues it was in the assembly, which is the most democratic part of the Athenian government, in which every male citizen had the ability to vote and influence things directly, true direct democracy. It was in this assembly that there was actually more of an oligarchy than anywhere else, because there were the orators, the relative few who possessed the serious skills with rhetoric to sway the assembly, to steer the assembly, if you want to be a little less cynical. These guys, not surprisingly, tended to be from rather wealthy elite backgrounds, to have had the education and training to be really, really good at rhetoric. However, the orators in the assembly actually didn't hold any formal political office other than just being another member of the assembly. So Alford argues anyway that they actually had to be very, very responsive to the wishes of the rank and file of the assembly in order to maintain any degree of power and influence. So this prevented even the great orators within the assembly from forming into the sorts of entrenched, semi-permanent or permanent oligarchies described by Mickles. Another article that finds an exception to the Iron Law of Oligarchy is one published in 2009 in the journal Sociological Forum by a guy named Peter Konieczny. Very, very stumped on the name. It's very Slavic, East European looking. K-O-N-I-E-C-Z-N-Y. Not sure how to pronounce it. But anyway, this guy examines Wikipedia as so far mostly another exception to the Iron Law of Oligarchy, and he sums up his own argument in the intro to the paper as, "Who says wiki organization says no to oligarchy?" Obviously in a reference back to a very famous line I quoted myself earlier from Mickles. Now, in the case of Wikipedia, power is very decentralized among its editors. And according to this guy whose name I can't pronounce, they deliberately seem to alter their policies from time to time in order to prevent anything like an oligarchy from emerging to exhibit elitist control on Wikipedia. And this scholar admits that an oligarchy could potentially arise in the future, but that if Wikipedia continues on its current basic course, that does not appear likely. And he raises interesting possibilities about, you know, the degree to which the internet and things like wikis can provide institutions and social organizations that are able to avoid the Iron Law of Oligarchy. So, worth pondering, I think. But in my opinion, and when you read these people writing about these exceptions, I think they agree with what I'm about to say too. In my opinion, when you examine these exceptions to the Iron Law of Oligarchy closely, there are usually specific and fairly straightforward reasons why these things are exceptions. Usually it's just the way that a particular organization evolved, either through happenstance or through deliberate policy, to prevent oligarchy from occurring. You can prevent an oligarchy from popping up in an organization, but you have to basically either be lucky or be smart in doing so. After all, exception means exception. It means something that is not typical. And the authors of all these studies of these exceptions themselves readily point out that what I just said. They admit these are relatively rare exceptions. You know, the authors of the book about the typographical union, they readily admit, hey, most unions are just like the Iron Law of Oligarchy says they should be. So there's usually specific contingent circumstances to explain an exception. Furthermore, the fact that you could find a relatively small number of specific exceptions to the Iron Law of Oligarchy doesn't invalidate the overall general accuracy and applicability of the Iron Law of Oligarchy. In other words, it still accurately describes what happens in most parties, unions, institutions, most of the time. So I hope this has given you stuff to think about. I hope I haven't lost you too much in the weeds, getting into kind of theory land and working in some sociology and other disciplines here. But, you know, I want to try and just share things with you that I find interesting and I find useful for sort of understanding the world and how it has been and how it is. I hope that this has given you some stuff to think about. I hope it's given you another analytical tool, if you weren't already familiar with this stuff, another analytical tool to put in your toolbox as you're trying to figure out and really get a grasp on both past and present societies and how and why they do what they do. For real, not according to the official playbook. I know that for me anyway, your mileage may vary, but for me, the Iron Law of Oligarchy was definitely one of those things that, and the things I'm going to cover as theories and concepts from time to time in this podcast are all these types of things. Something that, when I first learned about it, it was kind of like I had just gotten an update on the prescription for my eyeglasses. In other words, I could see fairly well before, but man, when I get that new updated prescription on there, suddenly everything is just a little clearer. Suddenly, you know, some things that were a little fuzzy kind of sharpen up, and you go, oh, okay, that makes sense. And you can look around at contemporary politics, whether you're American or not. You know, I can tell, like I've looked at the stats, I've got listeners all over the world, and that's awesome. That's awesome. I'm super stoked about how many international downloads I've been getting. No matter what country you're in, I think if you look at the government of your country, you'll see the iron law of oligarchy at work. In some places, it might be more obvious than others, but it's there. At least, I mean, you let me know. If you live in some country where this is totally not happening in your system, I'd love to know about it, because, hell, I might want to move there. if there's some like hidden little obscure country that I've just never heard of. I mean, some countries are better. Some countries have less iron law of oligarchy happening than others. But, you know, obviously like North Korea has a bit more than Switzerland, right? But it's present to some degree, as far as I'm aware, in every country that currently exists. Interestingly, by the way, I've got downloads from dozens of countries, not a single one from North Korea yet for some reason. Not sure why. Can't imagine. So anyway, I hope you found this interesting and illuminating as well. As always, I hope I haven't wasted your time. Thank you for listening. Please feel free to comment on this episode at prophecyday.org in the comment section for this particular episode. You can also email me if you'd like to comment on this episode, any other episode, the podcast in general, questions, comments, suggestions, feedback. It's profcj, P-R-O-F-C-J, at profcj.org. You can also connect with me on Twitter and Facebook. There are widgets for both on profcj.org, links to the Facebook and Twitter pages for this show. And of course, you know, if you connect with me on those, you can get updates on when an episode comes out, things I'm working on, that sort of thing. And then you can give me feedback via those venues. You know, let me know what you think of an episode that I've done or an episode I'm talking about working on. Sometimes in the future I'll post, you know, what I'm working on for next week or something like that. And remember, too, if you like what I'm doing, want it to continue, want it to grow, there are multiple ways you can help the show. Of course, just spreading the word to anyone you might know who might be interested in it, using any methods you have. If you've got a blog and you enjoy this show, hey, why not mention it on your blog? Get me a few more listeners. I'd appreciate it. Another thing you can do is stuff like leaving reviews at iTunes or other places where the podcast is available for download. You can contribute financially. I sure would appreciate that as well. I try to do this as much on the cheap as possible. I really do try to be an intellectual guerrilla warrior, but you know, still ain't free. And you can do a direct financial donation via PayPal. Go to profcj.org/donate. The other thing you can do is purchase items from Amazon.com after going through the links that I have to Amazon on profcj.org, and I'll get a little kickback there. Comes out of Amazon's end of the deal. Doesn't cost you any extra. So this has been Prof. CJ on the Dangerous History Podcast. As always, doing my utmost to help you learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's P-R-O-F-C-J.org.